Hello, and welcome to Out of the Frame, conversations about photography. I'm Pia Johnson, your host, and this podcast features conversations about photography, creativity, and the world we live in. I'll be talking to other photographers, curators, academics, and researchers about their work, artistic process, and how they feel about contemporary photography. Today's episode of Out of the Frame, Conversations About Photography, was recorded on the lands of the Dja Wurrung country. I'd like to acknowledge traditional owners of the land that we live, work, create, and thrive on, the people of the Kulin Nation. I pay respects to their elders, past and present. It always was and always will be Aboriginal land. My guest today is Minami Ivory, who is a photographic artist based in Tasmania, Australia. Born and raised in Hokkaido, Japan, she moved to Australia at the age of 15. Her practice blends analog and digital photography, incorporating paint, text, and collage to deepen meaning. Centered on issues affecting women in Japanese society, her work has been showcased in art prizes and photography festivals, both nationally and internationally. Thanks, Minami, for coming today to chat to me on the podcast.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm a big fan of this podcast, so I'm so excited to be here.
Well, I'm really excited to talk to you as well. I thought we'd just jump in, and I'd love to hear how you started taking photographs.
So photographs are quite a new thing to me. Because when I actually studied the Bachelor of Contemporary Arts at university in Tasmania, I majored in painting. And then I wanted stability, and also I didn't see myself as a dedicated artist. So I did my teaching degree and I became an art and Japanese teacher. And I became interested in photography when I met my friend Sarah Rhodes, who is also a photographic artist based in Tasmania. We just met by chance because our children went to the same primary school, and she was doing her PhD. And her work was about how the environment shapes who we are. And she was looking into how, especially how Tasmania, the island of Tasmania, affected who we are, because she thought we were quite different from how people were shaped in the mainland, I guess, which really like in isolation, I guess, because we're quite like isolated and things are a little bit different these days. But like when I moved here, which is over 20 years ago, like there was no social media. People were really different. Like they were just their own people. Like when I came, I was like, what have I done to myself? It's a beautiful place though. She took photos of me over the course of maybe a couple of years, and she uses large format camera, and I had never seen one before in my real life. And just watching her using the camera, it was just, I guess it was like an art itself. Mm. So like we'd spend maybe 2 to 3 hours, maybe longer than that, just to take maybe 4 photos, yeah?
Wow, that's very slow. Oh, my gosh.
Like such a huge process. We'd be outside and we'll be talking. And
that must be her process. Everyone, yes, I think has a different process. So, yeah.
And I just felt something, like how I felt between Sarah and I, and having that camera in between us, just felt magical. Like it felt like the process mattered the most.
Wow.
Rather than the end product. I'm sure to Sarah, the end product did matter, but to me, it was more about the process. And then she invited me to a photo book workshop run by Lewis Lim. So he's another photographic artist in Australia, but he is my printer now. So he runs Loop Imaging in Brisbane, and he came down to Tasmania and ran a photo book workshop, and that's when I got introduced to photo books, and it blew my mind. And I was like, oh, but I don't take photos. What do I bring? And she's like, well, you bring your children's photos, because I did take photos of my children. That's all I did.
Yeah.
She's like, I've seen them on Instagram. Just bring them. And then I was like, okay. And then halfway through the workshop, the penny dropped. I was like, oh, okay, photo book. Yeah, okay, I know what we're doing now. So I incorporated my children's drawings.
Mm-hmm.
So scanned them, and also photos of, like, Polaroid photos of us, Polaroids of me and my husband taken by our children.
Okay,
so it
cool.
was like all mixed up, and Lewis just put them in this sequence, and it just... I just fell in love with photography then, I think. I think that's what it was like. I just felt what everyone else has been feeling behind the camera.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, I know what they're talking about now. This is, yeah. So this is awesome. So that was the end of 2021.
Okay.
Yeah. So, and then 2022, I started using my camera that I had at home, and I just started taking photos then. Yeah, and here I am. I haven't stopped.
I love that. But what I love specifically is that it was such a simple act of being having your portrait taken to then using those really familial, vernacular kind of everyday items of family, and transforming them as a book, but then you're like, yes, this is it. This is the magic. I think that is something we forget sometimes when you've been taking photos for a long time or making artwork, that actually there is something that just lights up in us that makes you want to do it more, right? They kind of give you that adrenaline kick or something.
Yes. And it was quite special, because when I got a job, I just stopped creating, like, altogether. I just didn't bother. I was a bit busy working and
family and all the things, right?
Yeah. So it was like maybe at least 10 years of non-creating, like, and not creating anything, and it was like dispersed.
Yeah. Well, you've been kind of prolific since, which is amazing. And what I find fascinating is that you mainly take photographs of yourself. So with those, that energy still of mark making and painting kind of embedded, and, you know, and that makes way more sense to me when I look at your work, that you have the painting background, but also even just the simplicity of using your kids' drawings and that kid perspective as well. But if we move into the series that you've taken, and they're very successful and they've really got a lot of attention, which you should be really proud of, because they're very strong emotional works. I think the thing for me that I'd love to hear about is, how did you decide to, what I like to say is, turn the camera on to oneself to take self-portraits?
There are lots of reasons, but it was accessible because I'm always available for myself. So, but also there are lots of reasons, I think. Lots of my works are about, not about myself, but it comes from my personal experience or perspective about the world. And then I start to blend that in into a bigger idea afterwards. So it's my story. So I thought I was the best person to represent it. And I do love taking photos of people, but I'm limited with time because I work full time with children. And I have children, so I take photos at nighttime or whenever I'm free, whenever my washing's done, or, you know, when I've got this moment. So I'm like, oh, I'm available. Let's go and take a photo. So I can't really organize anyone to be in my image. But I love it so much because when I'm getting the self-portrait done, it gives me that feeling like I'm in lost in the process. So it's a little bit, it reminds me of painting. It's so process driven. So, and that goes back to when Sarah took photos of me, because sometimes that process of self-portrait is more important than the end product to me. Sometimes I can't even tell if the photo is actually in focus. Because I started to use medium format, and like you have control of it to some extent, but I can't really tell. So sometimes I'm in the dark room looking at my images like, oh, it's blurry. But that I felt something in that moment, and that's more important to me, I think.
I also think that every photo doesn't have to be in focus, right?
Yes, yes.
Like,
yes.
And with such emotional content and offering that you're doing by putting yourself in the picture, yeah, we all have fuzzy bits, right? Like,
yes,
nothing is just clean all the time or black and white. You know, there is the nuanced and the liminal and the grey spaces and the out of focus life moments. So it's kind of beautiful about that. But yeah, medium format's not easy, and especially analog, like film medium format, is not easy. Mm. So that's pretty impressive that you do that setup.
Oh, that's nice. Thank you. I do take digital camera as photography still, but I'm just in love with darkroom process at the moment because that's close to painting as well, I think, because you're getting into it and you're practicing printing.
Yeah. It's more material as well, I think, yes, like in terms of the process and going back to that idea of process. So how do you, I mean, maybe we talk about one of the first series of works that I found or heard about you was Counted, Graded, Numbered.
Yes.
Which is a very, very personal, I kind of feel, story, but also a universal one in terms of, you know, you're not alone in going through trying to get pregnant, trying to think about fertility, trying to be a parent. Do you want to explain a little bit how that work came about?
I think I don't see a counsellor. I'd love to, but
therapy is good, yes.
But I think counsellors are a little bit like teachers. There's all, you have to gel. It's quite personal. They're all great. Every single counsellor out there, I'm sure they're fantastic. But it's a bit like a teacher. Like I'm sure in my classroom, because I'm a high school teacher, there's always one or two students that wouldn't benefit from me. They just don't gel with me. And that's just, you know, it's just life, isn't it? And it's the same. I've tried counselling and I haven't met one that I gelled, and I found my art was much better, which is a bit dangerous, but I still do. So art is a form of processing my pain. I think that's what it is. So sometimes it's like I just have to process this pain and anger. Let's just put it through my camera and see how it feels. So Counted, Graded, Numbered was done. Because I think my infertility, I think I went through the treatments maybe like in 2016 to 2018, I think, or even a bit longer. So I decided to deal with that sadness a few years later in 2022. So it was like after process, like it's like, yeah, okay, I might just share that pain. Because when I was going through it, I was completely closed off. I didn't really want to talk to anyone about it. I was just looking at my calendar and, you know, checking all the signs. Am I pregnant? Oh, no, I'm not. Just driving down to Hobart because we didn't have a specialist in Launceston. So just like, you know, just endlessly, mindlessly driving down to Hobart and getting the treatment done and then being disappointed. And I just felt like I needed to process stuff. Okay, let's go back and process that pain. So, and it felt a little bit easy because it was universal idea. And I read the novel called Breasts and Eggs by Misako Kawakami, I think. I hope I got her name right. She's a Japanese author. And there was a scene that the character crushed her eggs on her face.
Wow.
Repeatedly. Yeah. And it wasn't about fertility, but it was the idea of women and then like just how difficult it is to be a woman in general and different stages of our life. And there was a scene that the girl did it, this teenage girl. And it, it just kind of sparked all the ideas about eggs. And that's where all the ideas came from, because I'm crushing eggs on my face because it felt like I was wasting my embryos and, you know, each month. And it was therapeutic.
Was it? And
Can
I ask, was it like cold eggs or was it room temperature eggs?
Oh, this is a debate. Do you keep eggs in the fridge outside?
Well, also, it's so funny. Eggs now I think are so special because we've had like bird, like, you know, like, that there's been bird flu and there's been all these things. So eggs are now these like divine things. They are like our embryos, right? Like they're very expensive.
Oh, that's right, actually. Actually, my husband was complaining because sometimes I'd go to the supermarket and this is when egg shortage was going around.
Yeah.
So I'd go, it's like, oh, there are hardly any eggs left in the fridge. And I had to go and get it. And he's like, why are you crushing that on your face? Anyway, it was cold, yes.
Yeah,
it was cold, especially in winter, yes, out of the fridge.
And they're so messy. I mean, I take my hat off to you. I'm not sure I could deal with egg. But they're very poignant, the works. And they do have a sense of inevitability about them, about life, as you say, like about women and fertility, but also just the vulnerability of being human. And they're quite poised in a way, even though clearly messy. Yeah. So how did you move from that work into Weapons of Choice, which is an ongoing work that, isn't it?
Yes. So Weapon of Choice was something that I've always wanted to do.
Okay.
Because it was from the trauma that I had when I was 14. So when I was at art school, I actually wondered if I could do something about it, because that's when I was maybe even 21, final year. And back then I hadn't even processed what happened. Like I kind of understood what happened, but I didn't. And I thought about how to express it, and I actually couldn't come up with any ideas. And now I understand why, because some artworks just, or even concepts, just can't be expressed unless you've had some kind of life experience. I think you can be a really young and successful artist because you've got really good skills, or maybe your concept that you're working on just gels with what your life is like now, maybe. But back then I just couldn't even start. And then it's been over 20 years since I had that summer, traumatic summer, and then counted graded number was finished, and then I just knew I could do it. It was bizarre because I'd be lying down in bed and all the images would pop out, all the ideas are like, oh, this is what I've been meant to be doing. And also everything just fell into place because the title Weapon of Choice is actually from Fatboy Slim's song.
I didn't really. Can you say it in Japanese?
Oh, does it have weapon of choice? Oh, does it say
on your website you have it in with the characters?
Oh, there's a character. So it says Saiko no Buki, which is literally means the best weapon in Japanese.
That's cool. Okay.
Yeah. I forgot I had that there. Yes, so it's the best weapon or weapon of choice. It was because when I turned 14, for my birthday, my parents bought me, or I chose the album for three foreign.
Fatboy Slim album.
It was Alanis Morissette, the whole celebrity.
Oh my gosh, we have very similar teenage taste. This is excellent.
Oh, that's funny. I love it. And then Fatboy Slim. And then that song. Yes, and I used to watch that music video clip on MTV and Christopher Walken's. And then
I love that. Like, isn't it the most liberating dance piece? Like, he's incredible.
And he actually choreographed what's the word?
Choreograph.
That's, yeah, he actually made all the moves, I think. And
yes,
that's just
that's
to
right.
think
he
that.
Did too now that you remind me.
Yeah.
I love that. Yeah, but also it's kind of interesting to pair that to the series, to be honest.
Like, I did listen to that song a lot in that summer. I think that's what it was. But it's Weapon of Choice, like, oh, because originally the idea of Weapon of Choice, and it still is in some part, because Weapon of Choice has a lot of messages, and the originally it was about no matter what happens in your life, you have yourself and you have to have weapon of choice to combat and live your life. And everything just, so you choose what you, what kind of weapon you use to live your life. Yeah. So it kind of gelled. Everything just fell into place.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, look, I think that's an amazing idea. Like, there's a mantra, right? Like, it means that you can be self-sufficient, you can be brave, but you're the agent of your life. Yeah. You know, I think so a few podcasts ago I was talking to someone, we were talking about that idea of living your life from a stance of abundance.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's a choice. You know, you have to choose, well, here's an opportunity, not a disadvantage here. You know, like, so I think that's a really interesting way to think about the title. And I love titles. I'm terrible at coming up with titles, especially for individual works in a series. But there is something really potent about that. Again, I use that word again because it's not a usual phrase that you would come up with.
No, no. And it has to be like a punchy, yeah.
But also, and the works don't have any weapons in them, you know, like,
yeah,
which is great. Like,
yeah.
I mean, how, and I guess moving from the first series that we talked about into this series, the performative aspect of you has just like gone up a massive notch, and you're adding in, painting and like collage and just all these different material interventions.
Yeah.
Is that, I mean, it is part of the process, but is that part of maybe to be real, like, to, you know, go in a bit too much, but like that idea of weapons, like that's that process of going, I'm going to rethink through how I can shape and shift those feelings or that representation or, yeah, all those different material interventions that you're doing feel very raw and playful at the same time.
Yes, I guess, yeah, I like that. It's the it's the ability of using different mediums to almost like a manipulate my memories into or even feelings towards like a more positive vibe or even angry vibe or something like all mixed up and jumbled up maybe. Yeah. I like that.
But also too, like you've written like that, I think, too. Do you print and then, like, can you explain your process, I guess, in terms of how you decide to, write on the images or paint on the images? How do you, like, what is the literal process? Yeah.
So, yes, the writing was done a lot in the first year, I think, because first year was pretty much counselling because I just needed to process. And there was a lot to process. It was intense, actually. It was the most intense year in this series, and I had a lot to say, lots and lots of things to say, and the picture wasn't enough. For me, it wasn't then, not because the picture wasn't good enough, because picture does tell 1,000 words, but I just had to write it in words and just express it so that it was out of my system, and I needed to understand what really happened. And so I was putting the words through it. Yeah, that's right. And then those ones, I think I used to write them on Photoshop. The words were with Photoshop, and then I actually took them out now So because I do want to make a photo book, and I've been thinking, oh, I'll just write lots of words separately. So I've got lots of writing happening, and if it's a book, you can do it, yeah? Because if it was an exhibition on the wall, I might have left words on the piece of work. But I'm heading towards photo book. God knows when that's going to happen. But but photo book gives you that ability of actually having words separately. It's like it can be a bit of a writing and an images. And so I've taken it all out. So I've got a Word document sitting on my computer now, and then pictures have lost all the words. But the painting process, oh, well, it started off with those young girls with no face on it. So that was the starting point. Okay. Now, these photos are from mostly from when I was 14.
Oh, wow. So, I didn't realize. So, okay.
Yeah, so because my parents kept my bedroom as it was when I left home when I was 15. Oh, so there's a bunch of things there. Oh, I love it so much. It's like, this is great. like, thank goodness my parents are hoarder. So, and I went through all the photos from that summer or that year.
Wow.
And the first photo that I painted, it was actually purely because I didn't want to use their face because I didn't even remember who those girls were. And then I just felt sorry for using someone's photo of, you know, just publicizing their face without permission. But also it gives me lots of ideas now, that concept, because in Japan or even like here, like for privacy reasons, we put blur on people's face, especially in Japan. There's a lot of that, like it's always been like that. So, and we always thought, why do you even, you know, you have someone being interviewed on the news and completely their face is blurred, but you can see their
the rest of their body.
And then, you know, and their voice hasn't been changed. So, like, you can recognize them if you really wanted to. So what's the point of censorship, I thought, what is the point? So you had a bit of that because, like, there's so much protection over underage people and or even, like, pornography. There's so much, like, in Japan we have to, they have to be blurred.
Okay.
Because it's illegal to show people's private parts on a
video. Yes, that makes sense.
Yeah. So, but what's the point? They're already, like, actors are embarrassed, maybe. There's no respect. So what's the point of trying to censoring these women? So it kind of made me angry, but it also has that because the sexualization of teenage girls and, you know, the law that doesn't protect young girls, it's changed now, and things like that.
But still, there's a resonance and a deep history, and even adult women are not protected. You know, there's a two-tier system, really.
Yeah, and it makes me just angry so much. And then so there's a bit of a point of that. Covering their face doesn't do much, does it? So I've painted a lot of that. And then so and also the girls just it feels like from that summer and in my era, because like it just felt like we were just bodies. We were just items. So it didn't matter if we had our faces. It didn't matter if we had our body. It was just this object.
Yeah, wow.
So as I progressed, there's some photos that you started off with just face being covered, but now I've got like a completely, you just can see their peace signs because that's what we did. And I put a peace up and then it's just all covered. You just see their peace signs and because we're just blending into the environment. And, as objects, really.
Yeah, wow.
So that I've got fair bit done and I can't wait to go home to my parents' place in September so I can collect
get
more
some more things.
Yes.
I mean, I think it's a really interesting way to consider women but also that kind of cultural societal push of of how we grew up. I think we must be similar age. But also to then to bring that from Japan to Australia, like to Tasmania, but also where we are in the world now, right? It's like really complicated and we have better language and better understanding, but it isn't necessarily different. It's also different, I think, for me when I became a mother, I was really all of a sudden aware of just all those complex social situations or baggage that I was bringing, or how do we model better or not, like, you know, this responsibility aspect of being a parent. But I think having a cultural background makes it even more tricky in, like, I guess when it's not a dominant culture, when you're in a minority culture, even though Australia is somewhat multicultural, it's still very much a settler colony. How do you feel the work kind of, or your work in that and trying to speak to Japanese society, but also just, I think, more broadly cultural safety and female safety works in this environment in Australia?
When I speak to people about like girls and women being silenced, I think there's a different levels of understanding. And, you know, like compared to some other countries, Japan is pretty good, yeah? Women can speak up, yeah?
Totally.
We don't have to be concerned about our lives or anything like that. So we're still quite lucky in that sense. But then in Australia, women, oh, my goodness, they speak up so much more.
Yeah. We have then, that freedom in a way, you know, like we aren't persecuted for a voice.
No, but then when I talk about this Japanese culture to women here, they're like, yeah, we have that. And I understand we do still have that here. Even like a little comments about breastfeeding in public or just little shame that we carry as women in a society. And in even this country, I feel it, but there's different levels. So I don't know how people are. Actually, I haven't really spoken to people about how they feel about my work. I think people that know me feel a bit awkward to talk about this.
Really? Oh, wow.
I haven't really spoken to my friends or colleagues about my work. They know that I'm doing something. I'm sure they've read it, but they feel a bit awkward.
Do your parents know?
No, so this is a bad thing. It's not bad. It's not bad, but it's like I'm like howling to like a little small dog to Japan from far away. I'm not even reaching because I'm such a loser kind of thing. But
you're not a loser.
Like, no, not a loser, but like it feels I'm not scared, but I haven't spoken to any Japanese person about how they feel about my work either. Which I'd love to, but I feel quite confronted. For instance, my parents know that I take photos and, you know, I do send them some images that are, you know, oh, I got featured here, Mum, like, I'll be proud.
Yeah, good.
And they do things like that. But weapon of choice, because it's so personal, and also my parents didn't see it happening, but, like, I was a runaway child, right? Like, I was... And my parents are beautiful. Like, I came from a beautiful family. Like, I was that rebel, that ungrateful child that decided to take, like, a play with fire, I guess. and then, like, I was sneaking out and, you know, like, I'm not going to go into that details, but, like, my parents had a hard time, yeah? They just wanted to protect their daughter, but it's been going, like, it was going since I was in grade 7. So it was like they just kind of gave up. Well, they wanted to protect me, but they gave up. And then it was a tough summer for them, and I especially feel it now even more because my daughter's turning 13 this year and I'm just the parent of teenager. I feel
respect.
It.
And then,
yeah, respect. Sorry, Mum and Dad. But also in Weapon of Choice, I also talk about how Japanese culture, it's improved a lot, but working culture is pretty harsh. And men, especially in the 90s and 2000s, they worked. They weren't at home. They just, my dad was, you know, he's retired, but he had to go out with his colleagues after work as part of, you know, meeting.
Right?
Yeah, it was their job. So there were a lot of times that my dad was, away from home. He was quite absent. And also he's a classic man from, you know, he was born after the war and, you know, he was...
It's that generation.
Right? He loves us. He's a great father, but also he didn't have much to do with us. So there was like an absence of father. And then the mum was a housewife then, and then she was just carrying everything, all the burden, yeah? When things went down, mum got to know one of the incidents that I experienced, assaults that I experienced, and mum kind of went in, she was upset, and I couldn't understand why she was upset because I was like, oh, shouldn't I be upset? I'm not sure what's happening. That's how I felt as a teenager. But as response, mum went, like, she closed her, like, herself, like, she didn't do anything. Not in a bad way, yeah? It was just her way of protecting me and herself. I think that's what it was.
Yeah.
So we didn't go to the police, we didn't go to the hospital, we didn't go to the counselling. There was none of it. We just kind of summer holiday finished.
Right? You just put it under the mat, under the rug.
Yeah. Yep. And that I just feel that if mum gets to know about this, she would feel so upset and guilty because she would think that I'm blaming her, that she is the one to blame. But it's not. That's not my point of the work at all. I'm blaming the society who made that situation for us. Well, there are lots of other factors, but...
Totally. Yeah. But I think that's a really pointed thing to say because we are living within the bounds of a society and a culture.
Yeah.
And I think it's really interesting what you were saying about your mum, but also too, I'm sure there's many moments in every country across the world that have similar, occurrences, which is really awful thing and sad thing to say. But I think that is the reality of living in those times and even now as well. But it's about processing it, right? Like I bring it back to that idea that you were saying it's kind of your therapy in a way. And it's a really, like, the images are beautiful and they're...
Oh, thank you.
They're complex and I didn't realize it. I mean, I think some of the things you've said today about that idea of covering up faces or just being bodies or just, you know, like I understand it now, but I think on first... reflection and viewing, you're never really sure what's going on. And I think that's a really, like, interesting tension in the work, you know, that one image doesn't necessarily speak to the next image in a kind of traditional series, but they kind of, when you, like, I've seen a few of them on your website and then on your socials and things, and it's like as you kind of bring them all together, they're this really powerful statement about women and young women. And you can kind of see both sides of, like, if you didn't know the context, you could just be like, oh, that's a really cool image. But when you do know the context and you know the place that they're coming from, it does feel like it speaks much more deeply and kind of core to how we experience the world. So I think that's a really... I think that is where, if anything, your mum, I hope, would be proud of you to be able to, like, express those feelings in such an incredible way through photos.
My work is not cohesive, I think, because it really reflects on how I'm feeling about trauma. Each day, because trauma changes its form each day. I think on some days I feel like it's nothing. I don't even think about it.
Wow.
Like,
yeah.
And then on other days it's like this huge burden that can affect my mood for the rest of the day, and I can close off quite easily. So Like when I'm feeling really strong, like being the advocate for those women and girls, and you know, I want to talk about this, systematic abuse against us, and you know, I'm gonna stand up front and just you know scream as much as I can, almost. But on other days, it's just like, whoa, that's bad. Like I can't even face the day. I need to express this, and so there's a lot of different moods coming in and going. So,
wow.
Which is a bit of a pain when I'm looking at all the photos.
No, I don't. But I think you know you're talking about a book next, which sounds really cool. And I feel like you're right. Like this work would make an amazing book. You know, because of its breadth and because it's not just one single linear line, you know, there is all those different inconsistencies and complexities and colours and just everything, you know. And I like that idea that, you know, the potential of text coming off the image but also maybe through the image. There's that idea of text kind of, and I'd love to know if you're going to do kind of multilingual, you know, or bilingual would be really cool, or, you know, just the way that text also can undo and or lean into different ideas that then the visual can kind of further complement is really, really great. So I wouldn't worry about the difference of the images because I think the book form allows you the intimacy of having the images with you all the time or in your hand and you can kind of lean in or not to me. That's very cool. How far are you with the project as a book?
So far away. I'm at home, in Japan in September. So I just need to take more photos and collect more images. And then it is at the end of the series. I can feel it. I've already got other ideas running in my head. And that's a good indication that I should just leave weapon of choice. It's so far away. I don't know. I don't even know where to start. Because English is another language to me, so I don't even know if my English writing's good, and I'd like to get someone to proofread it, but I don't even know who to approach because it's quite a heavy topic and personal. To answer your question, I have translated to Japanese, so it is bilingual.
Great.
But also going back to my parents, I'm so scared that my parents get a hold of that book
one day. Then they can read it.
That's bad.
Oh, dear.
It's like a naughty teenager being scared of
It's funny, isn't it, that idea of parents, especially – I know for me sometimes it's that thing of like I want them to know but I'm not sure they'll fully understand and that's okay. And being an artist is I think a really fascinating identity because you are always moving between different spaces and you are incorporating things like being a teacher or being a parent or I want to say thank you for sharing such deeply personal stories with me today and through your work. So I feel very grateful for you to feel safe enough to do that. So thank you.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
But I guess I might end in asking you how you feel about your photography and what you think the future for you in your work and maybe these new ideas, these new images that come to you in the middle of the night, are working on next?
So I see my camera as my it's like a pacifier thing, a dummy. It's a soothing tool. So I'll hold on to it dearly for the rest of my life, I think. Photography is for me, I think, when I met photography and that helped me to express weapon of choice, I think. So this is it for me and I'm really happy and I'm really happy that the painting is being incorporated. Some ideas. There are lots of different ideas. There's one topic that I wanted to do when I started photography, and I couldn't actually do it properly. I couldn't just figure out, which is about a third culture identity. So I used to call it triangle people, but I think that sounds lame, so I need to
There's a whole range of stuff on third culture kids, I think, is the phrase, or third space, which is very kind of 90s, actually, when it first started.
Oh, okay. So, wow.
Yeah, we should definitely talk. I've got lots of reading I can give you.
Oh, this is awesome. So I treat it as a triangle. So the which I can't find on the internet or any book. So if you can find it, that's perfect, please. Because someone told me about this once and I can't find it anywhere.
Okay.
It's the concept of, let's say I was a circle person from circle country, and then I Japan, and I moved to Australia where people were square. And I don't fit in the square culture. So I tried my best. Try so hard to fit into this square culture, but I can never be that square person.
Yeah.
So I became a triangle.
I love that idea.
So I was putting this huge MDF board triangle on myself and taking photos, and it just didn't work. I just like, oh, this is crap that I'm off. It wasn't great. It was
maybe it needs to be an empty triangle. Like a friend, those magnetic, I don't know if your kids have ever had it, but they're those really cool magnetic little shapes, and they're empty on the inside, and you can build them up into
I know
some
the
are square
one.
And some are triangular.
Who knows?
That sounds cool. But I think that's something, especially in Australia, that would resonate with lots of people, you know. The idea of being in between cultures, belonging, not belonging, where are you from, where are you really from, all those questions that we come across all the time. So I'd love to see your ideas for that.
Yes, but I'm not sure. Yes, and there are a couple more, but look, yes, I can go along. So I don't know which one to pick, but at the moment I'm more inclined to taking photos of my 12-year-old daughter of me coping being a teenage parent.
Oh, well, I'm sure they'll be beautiful as well.
So so lots of ideas. So I'll see what happens, but I'll finish Weapon of Choice properly. Mm. We better say it's important to say goodbye to something that's done good for me. And hopefully, the biggest dream is to be big in Japan. So that's really important. So I want to reach out people in Japan and actually share my work, even though I'm too scared about Weapon of Choice being in Japan. So that's my dream. Yeah, let's do that. Yeah.
I love that. You have to put it out in the world and then it will come true.
We can only try.
Totally.
Yes. Yeah.
Look, thank you so much for your time. I love your work and it's so exciting to see the different directions that you're taking, and so lovely to talk to you. So thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Pia.
Out of the Frame is supported by RMIT University Press Play Studio, is produced by Pia Johnson, music by Steph O'Hara, and graphic design by Brent Leadovitz.